Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Alex Sears and my guest for this session is playwright Simon Stevens. The last time we spoke, the subject was his 2006 play Motortown, about a soldier going haywire on a road trip after returning from Iraq. This time we'll be looking at his two most recent plays, Pornography and Harper Regan. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Simon Stevens.
Thanks, Alex.
Let's start with Pornography. Could you give a brief outline of what it's about and why you wrote it?
Sure. Pornography is a play that's divided into seven parts,
yeah,
or seven chapters. It's probably the none I'm happiest with. It tells six stories and one series of obituaries, six stories that play over the same 7 days at the beginning of July 2005, the first seven days of the seventh month of 2005. The second day of which was the day of all the stories playing out in and around London.
Mm.
The second day of which was the day of the Live 8 concert in Hyde,
yeah,
Park, that was organised by Bono and Bob Geldof to raise awareness about third world debt in an attempt to get G8 leaders to eradicate the third world debt. The sixth day of which was Wednesday, the 6th of July.
Yep.
It was the day that London was successful in its application to host the 2012 Olympic Games.
Right.
And the seventh day of which was the 7th of July 2005, in which four boys took suicide bombs onto the London Underground, one of which failed to explode and then exploded on a bus in Russell Square.
There's also the G8 meeting.
There's the G8 meeting in Gleneagles, in Gleneagles in the east of Scotland.
Hmm.
So there are six stories and one series of obituaries. The seven parts based on Jacques's 7 ages of man speech from As You Like It, all,
yeah,
of which interweave around these 7 days in
and
London.
What you've done is you've started with scene seven,
yeah,
and counted down,
yeah,
to scene one,
yeah,
but the actual order is the same as Shakespeare.
It's the same,
isn't
as Shakespeare, yeah.
So you start off with infancy, then,
exactly,
childhood,
exactly,
then the lover,
yeah,
then the soldier,
yeah.
Why did you choose that as a kind of form?
It's a speech which has haunted me for, 6 years, I guess. I've wanted to build a play around that speech for about 6 years. I saw Marianne Elliott's production,
mm,
of As You Like It in the Royal Exchange. It was the first production I saw at the Royal Exchange on my residency year.
Oh, yeah.
And it was an intoxicating production. It was tremendously vivacious, as all her work is. It had a great detail and great life. Peter Guinness played Jacques. And I loved its melancholy, and I loved its simplicity. It's an idea. The idea of the Seven Ages of Man is not original to Shakespeare.
Mm.
It's a kind of traditional medieval, kind of Renaissance idea.
Yeah.
But as was his wont, he articulated it with a certain amount of clarity. I think in Pornography, I wanted to dramatise a city. I wanted to dramatise a city that I really loved. The artistic director of the Abbey came to see it in Edinburgh and described it as a love letter to London.
Mm.
And I think there's a truth in that.
Yeah.
It's a city which is organic. It's a city which is explosive. That was an unfortunate adjective.
Yeah.
It's a city which is expansive,
yeah,
and contradictory and chaotic.
Mm.
Now, if you're going to dramatise that, I think it's essential that you have a form to contain it within.
Mm.
Otherwise, you're just left with entropy and you're just left with mess.
Yeah.
So it was really exciting to me, to having wanted to build a play around that speech and around that form for 6 years, to then land on the idea of writing about those 7 days. I thought, this is the play for that form.
Mm. And you decided to number them in reverse order,
yeah,
because it was why?
Yeah, well, that was kind. To give it a countdown,
yeah,
in simple terms, to give,
yeah,
it a countdown.
Yeah.
What I always think is true about as a playwright, I'm very nervous about audiences getting bored.
Yeah.
I think it's one of our biggest responsibilities is,
yeah,
to not bore the audience. Actually,
yeah, yeah,
I'd agree,
absolutely,
with Anthony Nielsen on,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the length of a play,
mm,
is not what bores an audience. What one of the things that can bore an audience is a sense of the possible endlessness of the play.
Yeah.
We like to know when a play is going to end. Now, we can watch a six-hour play, and if we have a sense that it's moving towards an inexorable and satisfying conclusion, we'll stay with it. We can watch a 20-minute play, and if it feels formless, it can bore the pants off us.
Yeah.
Now, having created this play, which was chaptered in form, I wanted to allow the audience to know that it wasn't going to necessarily continue to chapter 94.
Yeah, forever. Yeah.
It wasn't going to go on forever, so I just built them backwards,
seven to one. Yeah, and also it announces this theme that you were talking about, of seven.
Exactly, yeah.
Why is it called Pornography?
Very good. It's a play... Okay. One of my most abiding memories of my response to the attack on London was an inability to share others' incredulity at the Britishness of the suicide bombers.
Oh, yes, yeah.
At the time, the amount of people who were horrified by the fact that these boys were English, that they were born and raised in Yorkshire or in southeast London, you know... Really took me by surprise. It manifested itself in kind of tabloid newspaper headlines, clearly, but not only just there. You know, dear friends of mine, family members of mine, whose political opinions I respect and trust, were appalled by the Englishness of the boys. It was a sense of being appalled that I didn't share. To me, it made a great amount of sense that what they did was born in England.
Yeah.
It made sense to me that their action was an English action.
Yeah, made actually, in Britain. Yeah.
It was made in Britain. Mm. You know, there's something about the fitness first backpacks on the second attack, on the 21st of July.
Okay,
those boys all had the fitness first backpacks. I think the guys on the 7th might have done as well.
Yeah.
But just felt very, very accurate and precise to me.
Yeah.
This was an action that was made in Britain.
Yeah.
It struck me that ours was a culture that was struggling to sustain itself. It struck me that all that surrounding me was a culture in which I was contributing to. I'm not kind of separating myself from the people who surround me, but it was a culture of transgression. People were breaking rules. People were testing boundaries. People were transgressing. It felt as though there was a kind of tear in the fabric, as though the country was kind of tearing itself apart. I mean, that sounds incredibly dramatic, but at the time, that's how I felt. It struck me that in order to carry out transgressions of the type described in the play, we need to consider the people whose actions the people who our actions are affecting as being in some way objectified. And it struck me that that process of objectification was in some way pornographic.
That we
were turning people into objects.
Yeah,
that we were alienating ourselves from one another. It was a pornographic process of alienation. So the pornography doesn't describe the movie industry or the internet hobby or the magazine industry. It describes this way of detaching ourselves from one another.
And that's a habit of mind that extends across society.
All over the place, exactly. So each of the six stories, each of the seven parts, are built around an act of transgression. Some of which might be very small, the faxing of a top secret report to a rival company. Some of which might be slightly bigger, having an incestuous relationship with one's sibling, or even bigger still, killing people. But fundamentally it's the same alienation that sits everywhere. And what I wanted to say with the play was those boys who did that weren't monstrous, they weren't evil, they weren't separate from England, they were part of us, they were part of England. That was the kind of idea at the heart of the play.
And on a small scale, for example, the old woman who knocks on the door, somebody who's having a barbecue and asks, could I have a portion of your chicken that smells so nice?
Yeah, I wanted the final transgression
to
be touched with the possibility of some kind of hope.
So
she knocks on a stranger's door and asks for a bit of scran.
And I mean, it's still a transgression, though. It's still something that most people
wouldn't do. Yeah.
Now, the other thing about the form is that the way you've written it, it's both monologues and dialogues, both narrative and interaction.
Yeah.
But there's never specified characters, so you could have this play can be performed by any number of actors, and it can be performed even more incredibly in any order.
Yeah.
Could you talk us through that a bit, please?
Yeah, in order to talk about that, I need a little bit to talk about the nature of its commissioning.
Yeah.
Because it was commissioned by a German theatre,
okay,
by the Deutsche Schauspielhaus in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And it was commissioned for a particular director,
yeah,
who's a man I've worked with in the past, and I'm working with again, called Sebastian Nübling,
yeah,
who's remarkably bold, visually confident, you know, theatrically physical, intellectually kind of daring director. It's terrific kinetic energy to his productions. He did a great production of Herons, in which he completely ripped the heart out of the play and recreated it, and it was fantastic.
That's one of your earliest
it's
plays.
One of the early, yeah,
2001
it was produced in 2001, that's right, written in 2000. Simon Usher directed it beautifully at the theatre upstairs, and Sebastian Nübling put a bomb in it in Stuttgart. I knew I was writing for him. I thought I could write you a traditional play, the type of play I might write for the National or for the Exchange, but you'd just rip it apart anyway, so why not rise to the challenge of that particular commission, and write something that would be, I'd said to him, I remember getting drunk with him in a bar in Hamburg and saying, I'm going to give you a present, mate. Yeah. and it was a present, it was a gauntlet and a gift at once, you know. So he's a director who's very brilliant at directing direct audience address. He does it a lot. He did it in Herons when there was none in the play. He's a director with a tremendous balletic kind of imagination, and with an instinct for formal explosion. So I kind of wrote, I tried to write for him. I always,
so in a way you're providing materials for him and the actors to use in the way they want to
And that's a challenge which is set under every production of this play that I've seen. I've seen four different productions of it.
Oh, right. Talk us through the different approach, then.
Nübling, having described him as, you know, a kind of iconoclast, is actually the loyalist of all the directors.
The loyalist
to the printed text.
Yeah.
In that he does it in that order. And he even numbers the chapters, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
right,
which nobody else has done.
Yeah.
There's a production in Nuremberg which I really enjoyed,
yeah,
where they did a chaptered version,
yeah,
but they switched the chapters round. So
they put
the story of the siblings,
yeah,
right at the end.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a production in Berlin,
yeah,
where they worked out the chronological order.
Mm.
So they did it from the earliest action on the Friday to the,
yeah,
final action, which actually means the play tops and tails with the siblings as well, which is interesting.
Oh, right. Okay, I didn't know that. Yeah.
And then Sean Holmes's production in Edinburgh this year, which is the British premiere, he created with the cast. I mean, I was in rehearsals for that production, but it was in the kind of, you know, the apocryphal middle weeks of rehearsals where the writer ducks out.
Yeah.
And together the cast and Sean created a structure that created a structure there was episodic like the chronological version, but rather than going in chronological order, went backwards and forwards in time, and was built more around kind of coincidence of theme or a kind of poetic synchronicity.
Yeah, because I noticed that sort of some of the sections are one voice, really, almost,
yeah,
the whole way through.
Yeah.
So in a way, that means that one actor would dominate.
Yeah.
And with Sean's production, then he mixes up the actors a bit,
yeah,
so that there are more voices coming in.
Yeah. 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 You know, the kind of, ironically, the shortcut way to describe it is to describe it as the shortcuts version. But you know, to use a term based on the Robert Altman movie, where stories intercut like that.
Yeah.
But something that Sean did and Sebastian Nübling did more was allocate voices within each story to other actors who aren't in that particular story.
Oh,
so
right.
In
okay.
the story, for example, of the woman who faxes the report to the rival firm, the other actors become her colleagues, or one of the actors became her son, or one of the actors became her husband. And he was really playful. He was really playful with that. There are images that recur, deliberately kind of recur throughout. The image of drinking a glass of whiskey. The image of listening to the radio. Coldplay's Yellow, which is a song I don't have a great deal of time for.
Yeah.
And now has been used really beautifully in two different productions. So it's kind of seared its way into my my imagination a little.
Now, you had eight actors in the German version, and also eight actors in the British one.
Yeah.
Do you think that somehow that is the default number? Or
yeah, I think it might be. I think it might be. It's slightly, you know. I think there was there was 8 in Berlin and Nuremberg.
Yeah. I've just counted those.
There's one production in a town in Germany where they didn't have a bomber, so they did the voice of the bomber as chorus. So the other actors did the bomber's speech.
Yeah.
I'd love to see it with 2 actors. I think it could be done with 2 actors. We did a reading of it at the National Studio with 2 actors. They need to be actors of incredible energy. And I also think there's scope for doing, you know, a big operatic kind of company of 20 or 30 doing it. And it was kind of written with the possibility that some incredibly wealthy German theatre company somewhere might rise to that challenge.
Yeah. But, and it's interesting that London, which is, as you pointed out, this great big polyphonic city, chaotic and mesmerising and a bit frightening, that you've managed to contain that and represent it through using this form. At the same time, you've also injected an element of fantasy, which I quite like.
Yeah.
And this is most obvious in the section that corresponds to the soldier in Shakespeare, which is the suicide bomber or bombers.
Yes.
In that you don't have them setting out from Leeds.
No.
You have them
West Dewsbury or wherever it was, from Stockport, which is where I'm from.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's really essential to me was this idea that the bombers are not monsters, the bombers are not different, the bombers are us, you know, potentially. They're English, you know. They were younger than me. I mean, the eldest one was 28, I think, wasn't he? So he was kind of 10 years younger than me. But so what I did was I described my journey, my journey to London. And I was really conscious in not wanting to write about Islamism, not wanting to write about religious ideology, not wanting to write about political ideology or about responses to British or American foreign policy in the Middle East. Clearly, they were important motivating factors behind the suicide bomb.
Absolutely.
Of course they were. Yeah. There are people who know more about that than I do who are writing about it with more clarity. If I wanted to know about that, I'd read Robert Fisk. I was interested in the humanity of the bombers. I was interested in the extent to which they were 17-year-old, 18-year-old English boys.
And they're boys that look out the window of the train and see our recognisable society, and they're very alienated from it.
Exactly.
Okay, another thing that's transgressive, let's say, is the two siblings.
Yeah.
And could you talk a bit about that? Because there was a production in which instead of a boy and girl, you had two boys.
Yeah, it was the original production, Sebastian Newbern's production. I remember, just to be clear for people who don't know the play, there's a story that runs through the course of that week in which a sister, as is written, goes and stays with her brother. And she's been estranged from him for a while. And the two of them are very, very in love with each other, and actually their love for each other manifests itself in a sexual relationship for the course of that week. We were rehearsing in Hamburg, and Sebastian said to me, I think when you put a man and a woman on stage together, regardless of what you tell people about their backstory, there's somewhere in the audience's imagination where they presume that they're going to fuck each other.
Also because, I mean, the two actors are not brother and sister, so...
Exactly, clearly. So he had a wonderful guy playing Jason, who's the second story, he's a school kid, and he recast at the end of the first week of rehearsal. So the actor who's to play Jason ended up playing a brother sibling, returning to see his brother. And the actress who was to play the sister ended up playing Jason. So it was a terrific androgyny in the whole production, actually. And what that meant was everybody was taken aback when the two boys kiss each other for the first time. You know, it reveals a lot about a kind of an assumption of sexuality in an audience. I've not spoken to gay friends about whether they were as alarmed as you got, as one got the sense that most heterosexual people in the audience were alarmed. I don't know how radical or transgressive it felt to a gay audience, but certainly it created a heck of a frisson. I mean, it does, you know, Sean's production with the brother and sister, I think that, you know, there were many people sitting around me who you could hear them gasping and hear them unnerved. That's actually become a standalone short film. that story. Right. It's going to be screened on Channel 4.
Okay,
that's
is
plugging
that quite
myself.
Soon?
I feel like I'm on Radio 5 Live plugging my book.
And
it'll be on next year, I think. Yeah.
Oh, and the play ends on 52. Mm. Very, very short fragments, once again.
Yeah.
It's a play of fragments,
yeah.
Isn't it? After all, fragmented stories. Fragments of the lives of 52 people.
Yeah.
And they're derived from the actual biographies
yeah.
of the 7/7 victims.
Yes, exactly.
So it's like a kind of chorus
yes.
that finishes things off.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's completely right.
Mm.
And it's something that... there are moral questions around that.
Mm.
The moral question being, is it voyeuristic
yep.
to use those people's lives? Or would it? Is it irresponsible?
Yes.
Is it... on the other hand, is it a tribute to them? Is it? Would it be irresponsible to not acknowledge the fact that 52 people died? You know, there's a moral debate. I don't have an answer to that, I'm afraid to say. There are also aesthetic questions around it, because what people who produce this play, every production that I've worked with, and I've kind of worked indirectly with three of them, the question that directors have come across is, how do you do that without it being saccharine, or without it being sentimental, or without it being mawkish? And if it becomes saccharine or sentimental or mawkish, then I think it does become irresponsible and voyeuristic, actually.
A sort of form of soft porn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It becomes pornographic in itself. Mm. And my response has always been, I think those obituaries are actually, they're almost as provocative as the killing of Jade in Motortown. They can be an incredibly unsettling gesture.
Mm.
People can watch them, or they can listen to them, and they can find themselves asking very troubling questions of themselves. Am I moved by these stories? Is it right to be moved by these stories? Am I being voyeuristic? Am I always voyeuristic?
Mm.
Am I bored by these stories?
Yeah.
If it goes on long enough,
it could be me, definitely not me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I wanted to write something that wasn't manipulative. That I hope it's not manipulative.
Mm.
I hope it's not sentimental or sensational. I hope there's a provocation in that, but at the same time, I hope it acknowledges the deaths. You know, it was inspired by things like the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, which is kind of overwhelming. Just the size of it is overwhelming. When you sit and watch it, you sit and listen to it in Sebastian's production, it's done on a speaker. In Sean's production, it was done as text after the curtain call. There was one amazing performance in Birmingham, because it was a co-production with the Travellers from Birmingham Rep. One performance in Birmingham. It was lovely throughout watching the audience notice it as they were leaving. Some audience members didn't notice it. A lot of audience members didn't notice it, especially in the context of the festival, where they were then rushing off to see a play in the assembly rooms or the Pleasance or whatever. And then you'd normally get about 10% would notice it, and about of those 10%, about 50% would sit and watch all of it. There was one night in Birmingham where, for some reason, everybody noticed it, and everybody sat and watched the whole list, which took about 10 minutes, and just sitting reading the details of these deaths, and these lives, actually, these details of the lives.
That's almost theatre as a public forum.